comprising its School of Medicine and Adult and Children's Health Systems, working together to advance knowledge and improve lives. StanfordMedicine.org. Well, every Sunday, KQED highlights a new local musician with an upcoming local show. You can tune in to hear the Sunday Music Drop, brought to you by the KQED Weekend News Team. That's Sundays at 5:35 within All Things Considered. Here's what's in store for All Things Considered this afternoon at 5.
American cowboys are synonymous with the Wild West. Dusty towns, desert plains, tumbleweeds. But a group of cowboys in Louisiana say that picture is incomplete.
Our culture, black culture and Creole culture in America, has redefined what it means to be a cowboy.
We tag along on a trail ride through rural Louisiana. Saddle up for All Things Considered from NPR News.
You bring your own spurs, and that's this afternoon at 5. I'm Beth Huizenga. This is KQED 88.5 San Francisco and KQEI 89.3 North Highlands, Sacramento. We're live online at kqed.org and always on the KQED app. 8 o'clock.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, President Biden in France salutes the veterans of D-Day and denounces isolationism. Also, German farmers protest EU climate rules they say could put them out of business. Sports, as the U.S. now become a cricket power. Also, Adria Arjona on her new film about a woman who tries to hire a hitman who turns out to be just a college prof going undercover. Refund? And Meghan Trainor's new album, a decade after she said, it's all about the bass, now it's family.
I don't know, a lot of people say your life ends when you have kids and it's their life now, but my life kind of ignited and started all over again.
First, our newscast at Saturday, June 8, 2024.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The Israeli military says its forces have rescued four people who had been taken hostage by Hamas militants on October 7th of last year, the deadly attack that started the war in Gaza. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports from Tel Aviv.
The four hostages were rescued were three men and one woman. They all range in age between 21 and 40, and they were all kidnapped from the Nova Music Festival on October 7th. Israel's military, police, and domestic security agency, they all participated in this rescue. They called it a, quote, so complex special daytime operation. It was in Nusayrat in central Gaza.
NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reporting from Tel Aviv. Israeli officials say all four are in good medical condition and under observation in an Israeli hospital. An organization for the hostages' families called the operation heroic and called on the government to bring all the hostages home. President Biden is welcoming the news of the safe rescue of the hostages and said the U.S. and Israel won't stop working until all the hostages are home. He also said that Russian President Vladimir Putin won't stop with attacking Ukraine, that he threatens all of Europe. Biden spoke in Paris, where he's on a state visit. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports.
Biden and President Emmanuel Macron stood together under the Arc de Triomphe Saturday morning in a ceremony at the Flame of the Unknown Soldier while the anthems of both nations played. The two presidents have a close relationship and see eye to eye on the conflict in Ukraine. After the ceremony, Biden headed to the Elysee Palace for a working lunch. The two presidents will sit down for a state dinner along with First Ladies Jill Biden and Brigitte Macron and other guests such as Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg, the star and director of the movie Saving Private Ryan, who came to Normandy to commemorate D-Day. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Hundreds of migrants who've attempted to cross into the U.S. without authorization over the last 4 days have been quickly deported as part of President Biden's executive actions halting most asylum claims at the southern border. NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran spoke with one of the migrants who had to return.
Many migrants told me that they are now trying to figure out what to do next after being deported to Mexico. But many said they are not going to try to cross again, which is the goal of the Biden administration, to deter migrants from crossing without authorization. Instead, the administration wants people to use legal pathways to claim asylum, like the CBP One app. But the platform can be problematic. Some users report getting error messages. Another limiting factor in the lottery system is there are only 1,500 appointments per day. People seeking an appointment say they have been left waiting for weeks, even months. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News, Nogales, Mexico.
You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. A Superior Court judge Friday granted a temporary restraining order to the University of California, temporarily halting a system-wide strike by thousands of academic workers who walked out over UC's response to pro-Palestinian protesters. That follows two failed requests by the UC to have state labor regulators halt the strike. Rafael Jaime is president of UAW 4811.
We expected the University of California to respect the agency that has the prerogative over labor issues. And, you know, instead they went to a judge in Orange County. And so we are surprised.
Jaime said the order does not mean the strike was ruled illegal. In a statement, UC said it is extremely grateful for a pause in the strike so students can complete their academic studies. Both sides are vowing to continue to pursue unfair labor practice claims against the other. A federal appeals court judge on San Francisco's Ninth Circuit is recusing himself from hearing a case brought by Palestinian rights activists who are seeking to block U.S. military support of Israel. U.S. Circuit Court Judge Ryan Nelson had been a member of the three-judge panel that will hear an appeal on Monday of a lawsuit accusing President Biden and other administration officials of complicity in genocide. Nelson is among a group of federal judges who visited Israel in March on a trip arranged by the World Jewish Congress, meeting with Israelis affected by the October 7th Hamas attack. Nelson, an appointee of former President Trump, said it was, quote, far from certain that an objective observer would reasonably question my impartiality. I'm Natalia Navarro. This is KQED News.
Support comes from Paint Care. Leftover paint can be dropped off and recycled at nearly 800 sites in California, paintcare.org. Support for NPR comes from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. And the listeners of KQED. Well, we do expect a lot of clouds and some hazy sunshine today. Winds out of the west up to about 20 miles per hour this afternoon. Temperatures ranging from the mid-60s in San Francisco to the upper 80s in the Sacramento Valley.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. President Biden is being celebrated in Paris with a parade, a private meeting with French President Macron, and tonight a gala dinner. Of course, the president is in France for a much more solemn reason. He marked the 80th anniversary of D-Day in Normandy, and yesterday he gave an address to the American people from one of the most storied sites of that battle, Pointe aux Coques. NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith was there. Thanks so much for being with us, Tam.
Glad to be with you.
What did the president want to most get across in his speech?
Well, he was at this memorial to the Rangers, the Army Rangers, who scaled the cliffs under a hail of bullets and grenades to take out German firing positions on D-Day. It is this incredible story. Most of them didn't survive the mission. None of the veterans are still living. But Biden invoked their memory. It was a short speech, fewer than 15 minutes, but it was aimed at inspiring the American people to want to defend democracy. And Biden drew a link between the Allies' fight against the Nazis and the West's support of Ukraine now in its fight against Russia. Here he is.
Does anyone doubt that they would want America to stand up against Putin's aggression here in Europe today?
And he also met with Ukraine's President Zelensky, didn't he?
Right. Earlier in the day, he did meet with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who has been in France for some of the D-Day commemorations. And this is significant. He specifically apologized to the Ukrainian leader for the delay in getting him funding, blaming it on opposition from, quote, some of our very conservative members who were holding it up. And during that meeting, he announced an additional package of $225 million in aid for Ukraine's defense that would be released to Ukraine. And the leaders also discussed, though not in front of the press, military strategy and had a frank conversation, we're told, about where things stand.
Tam, the president obviously marked a solemn historic occasion, but was there a political dimension to his speech as well?
There always is. It was not overtly stated, but if you wanted to look for comparisons to former President Trump or implications about what a second Trump presidency would be, it was certainly there. Biden has been saying over the course of his time here that democracy is more threatened today, both in America and across the globe, than it has been any time since World War II. And as part of this speech, he urged Americans to think of democracy as a cause greater than themselves.
American democracy asks the hardest of things, to believe that we're part of something bigger than ourselves. So democracy begins with each of us. It begins when one person decides there's something more important than themselves.
And I will note that defending freedom and democracy are quite literally themes of President Biden's reelection campaign.
And the president is going to another military cemetery tomorrow, this one northeast of Paris, where there was a pivotal battle in the First World War. What's the significance of the president's appearance there?
More than 2,200 Americans who fought and died in World War I are buried at that cemetery, and it is the same cemetery that former President Trump, back in 2018, was supposed to visit, and then he skipped. The White House said it was because of bad weather, but a different story emerged 2 years later in an article in The Atlantic magazine, and that is something that Biden talks about at every fundraiser he does, and often in public events too, including this one in Scranton, Pennsylvania a few weeks ago.
I have to say, there are a lot of things that Donald Trump has said and done that I find extremely offensive. The one that offends me the most is when he refused as president to visit an American cemetery outside of Paris when he was president. Why? He said that those soldiers who gave their lives were, quote, because his quote, suckers and losers.
Now, Trump has denied that he denigrated the people buried there. He has denied that repeatedly, though his former chief of staff, John Kelly, has gone on the record in recent months confirming the details of that Atlantic story.
Do we expect that Donald Trump will be brought up at this appearance?
It is highly unlikely that he will invoke Trump's name, because remember, he will be at a cemetery, and the whole purpose of that visit is to honor the war dead. However, when he is back and he is at fundraisers or at giving campaign speeches, I can absolutely guarantee it that he is going to bring up this experience of being there and Trump not.
NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith, thanks so much.
You're welcome, and au revoir.
Au revoir. The European Union holds parliamentary elections this weekend. Observers say right-wing parties are poised to make gains. One group pushing Europe in this direction are farmers. In the past year, farmers from Poland to Spain have staged dramatic protests against EU climate policies. They say the rules make it impossible for them to make a living. NPR's Rob Schmitz reports from rural Germany.
Last year, Anthony Lee received a letter from the Agricultural Ministry of the state of Lower Saxony, where he runs his family's farm. The letter informed him that a tree had fallen on his land, removing the cultivation potential of a few hundred square feet of sugar beet fields. His annual farming subsidy would therefore be reduced by around $10.
Every 3 days, satellites fly over our fields, and then every farmer has to download an app. And if we get a push message and saying, on your field, such and such, there's something not right, take a picture and send us this picture. That's how crazy it's gone now.
21st century farming in Europe means GPS-enabled tractors, climate change-inspired rules, and crop rotations monitored by cameras in space.
If the satellite picture shows the government that something is not correct with that, what you tell them. So if you say we grow wheat and you grow corn, it will automatically send them a message, there's something wrong.
Lee says it's beginning to feel like the state is slowly taking over his farm. He's not alone. So far this year, farmers in every part of Europe have staged more than 4,000 protests, a 300% increase over last year, according to global risk data firm Verisk. They're angry about new environmental regulations, the removal of subsidies, and cheap agricultural imports that don't meet the demands placed on the food they produce. Several of these demonstrations have turned violent, like this protest in Brussels, the seat of government for the European Union. Farmers pelted police with beets and then sprayed liquid manure on them before police responded with tear gas and water cannons. Alan Matthews, retired professor of European agricultural policy at Trinity College in Dublin, says European farms are mostly small-scale operations, and for hundreds of years, farmers here have become masters of working the land. Matthews says far more is expected of the modern European farmer.
We're now also asking them to be, part ecologist, part nature conservationist. They need to know, how they're impacting on greenhouse gas emissions. So there's a whole range of additional obligations, requirements, if you like, that we're asking farmers to make.
Matthews says the farmer protest movement across Europe in the months leading up to the EU parliamentary election reminds him of the climate change demonstrations that led up to the last EU election 5 years ago.
We now have farmer protests instead of youth protests prior to the European elections, but I think that protests in themselves are likely to have a similar impact.
Matthews sees the changes in the draft of the five-year strategic agenda published by the European Council, the top decision-making body of the European Union made up of the EU's heads of state. The last five-year agenda outlined a transition to a greener, more sustainable Europe.
All of that language has disappeared from the current draft of the next strategic agenda.
This shift has alarmed many politicians concerned about the environment. Michel Blass, a German member of the EU Parliament for the Green Party, says stalling climate change policies to placate protesting farmers is a step backwards for Europe.
Their whole sector hasn't been really regulated in terms of climate, so it cannot be climate policies that makes them angry. But for sure, we are fighting together with them to get better prices. But here, this is something that it's not the Greens who are responsible for, but it's the big retailers who don't give them enough for their produce.
For German farmer Anthony Lee, low produce prices are a problem, and that's why he's turned to other sources of revenue.
So this is where we have the rooms, three rooms here, and we try to build it so you can see all the old woodwork in that.
He gives a tour of a small hotel he's built on his land to make up for lost revenue from the farm. But Lee says the bigger problem is the Green Party.
It's definitely an agenda to get rid of small farming businesses. They tell us the opposite. The first farms that go bankrupt are small farms because they can't cope with this system.
Lee has taken to YouTube to air his grievances. His videos have more than 30 million views. He's also running for EU Parliament for the right-wing Free Voters Party. He's attracted media attention for blaming politicians for wanting to take farmers' land to build housing for refugees, something he's provided no evidence for. Lee shrugs off this criticism, saying he does not belong to the far right. He says he's simply a family farmer who wants the EU to return more decision-making powers to those who work the land and feed Europe. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Lower Saxony.
You're listening to NPR News.
Support for KQED comes from SF MoMA, welcoming music lovers to celebrate 100 years of music and design. Art of Noise features over 800 works from rock posters to hi-fi listening experiences. On view now, more at sfmoma.org. And European Sleepworks, the store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and bedding at sleepworks.com.
Will AI become inescapable in the same ways as smartphones and social media? And if so, is it still possible to shape its role in our lives? As companies rush to incorporate AI into their business plans, this week I want to hit pause to ask questions the AI revolution might be skipping over. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
It's Been a Minute that comes your way every Saturday morning at 10 on KQED.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Israeli authorities announced today their forces have rescued four hostages who had been kidnapped by Hamas on October 7th in a complex daytime operation in central Gaza. The hostages are said to be in good medical condition. Former astronaut William Anders has died at the age of 90. He was part of the three-man Apollo 8 crew. He took a picture of the Earth from space called Earthrise. His son said Anders was flying a plane alone when it crashed off Washington State. And in hockey, the Stanley Cup Final opens tonight. The Edmonton Oilers are trying to become the first Canadian team to win the Cup in more than 30 years. They play the Florida Panthers. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Capital One, offering their travel card venture, What's in Your Wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law and the listeners of KQED. Some clouds to start off the morning and then hazy sunshine this afternoon. Some winds out of the west up to about 20 miles per hour. High of 64 degrees expected in San Francisco, 68 in Oakland, 70s in the North Bay and the peninsula, upper 80s in Sacramento Valley.
In addition, from NPR News, I'm Scott Simon. There are growing fears that attacks between Israel and the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah are intensifying and could lead to an all-out conflict. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says that Israel is prepared for what he calls a very intense military operation along the border with Lebanon to bring security to the north of the country. The Iranian-backed Hezbollah says that its attacks are in support of Palestinians who are under Israeli bombardment in Gaza. Mohammed Haj Ali is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut. He joins us now from London. Mr. Ali, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Why do you think there's been an increase in violence now?
The Hezbollah movement has been keeping the pace very low for many, many months. But now they see an opportunity in Israel's precarious position, given the international scrutiny of its actions in the Gaza Strip, and also given the U.S. pressure on Israel to contain its operations and have a day-after plan in the Gaza Strip. This presents an opportunity for Hezbollah to escalate, one, to increase the pressure on the Israeli government to accept a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip and a deal that would eventually lead to the end of hostilities. And at the same time, secondly, to try and slow down the Israeli advances in the Rafah region in the Gaza Strip. Given that this is the last battle within the Gaza Strip, it only makes sense for Hezbollah to increase its attacks, given that the goal of Hezbollah's engagement in the operation on October 8th was basically to show solidarity for the war going on in the Gaza Strip. So now is the time for the organization to increase its attacks.
How do you read Israel's strategic goals?
So Israel has two strategic goals. The first is to find a new security arrangement in the north than the one that we have right now in place. Now, the security arrangement is based on the Security Council Resolution number 1701, which allowed for 12,000 UN peacekeeping force to secure the border region. In addition to that, there are thousands of Lebanese armed forces in the southern of Lebanon near the borders. These are now not sufficient for Israel, given that they're not really able to keep Hezbollah away from the border region. So Israel wants a new security arrangement, new guarantors, and for it to establish that, they need to increase the attacks and widen the scope of violence in South Lebanon. And this is exactly what they're trying to do. The second strategic goal is to have its 100,000 residents who are now internally displaced return to the north of Israel before the start of the new school year. This is an increasingly important issue for the electorate in Israel. And I think for Netanyahu and the Israeli establishment, this has become a priority.
Mr. Ali, how dangerous a time is this?
If Israel launches an all-out war on Lebanon, this would trigger a domino effect in which other actors, non-state actors across the region, would join in, leading to an escalation not only with Israel, but perhaps also with the United States. And that would have an impact on the energy markets in the rest of the world. This will have another Ukraine effect globally.
A Ukraine effect in what way?
The Ukraine effect is basically the impact that the war had, the inflation that we've seen due to the change in energy prices. A war in the Middle East would mean higher oil prices and also instability for some time, given the lack of clarity about what happens next. So a war with Lebanon would lead to an engagement from the Houthis in Yemen, further attacks from Iraq, from Syria, and perhaps some U.S. involvement at some point, and that would drag in some other actors and players and would lead to further instability. It's a conflict that would have global ramifications and will not remain limited to the Middle East.
Mohammed Haj Ali of the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
How are double disapprovers feeling? And no, I don't mean when our dog, Daisy, and cat Gato Blanco are unhappy with me.
The last time the double hater or double disapprover voting percentage was this high was back in the 2016 election between Trump and Hillary Clinton, and they broke pretty decisively towards Trump.
NPR's Susan Davis, Mara Liasson, and Scott Detrow in conversation later today on why voters disapprove of both President Biden and former President Trump, how that might affect the vote in swing states. You can listen later today on NPR's All Things Considered. Tell your smart speaker to play your member station by name or turn on the radio. Daisy and Gato think radios are cool. When spring comes to Alaska, it brings out all kinds of animals, migratory birds, fish, and seals. And for people who rely on hunting and fishing for food, that means fresh meat. In many indigenous villages along the western coast, women celebrate by holding what are called throwing parties. Emily Schwing from member station KYUK explains.
On a Sunday afternoon in late April, the women of Mukhtavik, Alaska, gather in Mildred Tom's front yard, 12 miles from Alaska's Bering Sea coast. Once the elders find their place in the middle of the crowd, Tom, her niece, and her daughter kick off the festivities. The women hosting the party grab fistfuls of treats and prizes from a big blue plastic box on Tom's front porch and lean out over the railing to fling all the goodies into the air. This is a throwing party. During this first round, a technicolored array of candy rains down on the crowd of women who scramble in slushy, melting springtime snow to fill shopping bags with their bounty.
Not too high!
Throwing parties are also called seal parties, or ugiguk, in Yuchtun, the indigenous language spoken in Alaska's Yupik region. Women have been gathering for parties like this for generations. Their purpose? To strengthen community bonds and friendships. They're meant to celebrate a first, usually the first seal or fish or bird hunted by a young family member. But the rules aren't hard and fast. So hostess Mildred Tom held this party to celebrate a daughter who graduated and a few of her grandchildren's recent achievements.
This is for all their first catches.
Like for fish and seal
everything
mosquitoes.
Mosquitoes. Flies.
Tom is one of about 200 people who live in Mukhtavik. In the years since the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, she says there have been far fewer gatherings in her community.
Since COVID, we haven't gotten used to having visitors or visiting around.
Tom spent months ordering gifts off the internet and stockpiling up goodies to toss out to her guests. Before anyone in Western Alaska could order things online, women used to toss out pieces of the first spring catch. Chunks of seal meat, some dried fish, strips of hand-smoked salmon. What Mildred Tom's family gives away is more modern, and it's more than just candy. Party horns, kazoos, and little toys, socks, gloves. The list of prizes seems endless. In the end, everyone goes home with something special, including renewed bonds that will last until the next throwing party. Someone is sure to host one when the subsistence season comes to a close in the fall. For NPR News, I'm Emily Schwing in Machtachweg.
And now it's time for sports. Stanley Cup Finals. Can a Canadian team finally make it? Caitlin Clark in the line between tough play and playing dirty. The cricket miracle in Texas, and I don't mean Jiminy. Michelle Steele of ESPN joins us. Michelle, thanks so much for being with us.
Howdy, Scott.
Game one of the Stanley Cup Finals tonight. Florida Panthers, Edmonton Oilers. Panthers would like to win their first ever Stanley Cup. Oilers haven't won it since 1990. Michelle, it has been 31 years since a Canadian team won the Stanley Cup. Oh my gosh, the horrors. Can they do it this time?
Yeah, 31 lonely years for the Montreal Canadiens, who won it way back when in 93. The Oilers could end that streak. You know, they do have the best player in the league right now, Connor McDavid.
Yes.
And it's going to be an incredible matchup tonight at Puck Drop, but Scott, the Americans, the Florida Panthers, they're just a deeper team. You know, they got a 60-goal scorer who might be the third or fourth best player on their team. They have the better goalie in Sergei Bobrovsky, who's been outstanding all postseason. And you know what? They've got motivation. The Panthers were in this exact same spot a year ago. They lost in the Stanley Cup final, and they want to finish the job this time.
You reported something for ESPN this week about a superstition the Panther players have developed.
Yeah, it's kind of like a weird reporting niche for me. I really love talking about superstitions with guys. And this is not routine. This is something that you do that might be a little bit irrational, that for whatever reason is working. And that 60-goal scorer I talked about, Sam Reinhart, he's on the Florida Panthers. He told me that a superstition that he's developed this season, after pregame skate during round two of the playoffs, this was like a month ago in Boston, he and a couple guys decided to take an Uber back to the hotel instead of the team bus. They won the game that night. They have avoided the team bus ever since. So whatever works for them. And, you know, hopefully for him, they take more Ubers the rest of this series.
And I hope they tip well, whatever, okay?
Well, they will have to now.
Yeah. Hey, thank you. Look, WNBA getting a lot of attention this week. And the league's physicality came under scrutiny after Caitlin Clark was painfully shoulder-checked by Kennedy Carter of the Chicago Sky.
Mm.
Some call it a dirty play. Others say it's just a welcome to the WNBA kid moment. Is it more than hazing?
Well, it wasn't a basketball play. That much is clear. Kennedy Carter from the Sky uttered an expletive, actually, before she shoved Clark, before the ball had even been inbounded. I was at Sky practice this week, and Carter expressed no regrets. She essentially just said she was playing Clark really hard. And agree or disagree with that, we have seen Clark and a number of high-profile rookies like Angel Reese in Chicago experience those hard fouls so far this season. And we've seen this in other leagues and other generations, whether it's Shaq or Jordan or Kobe. When you come into the league as a generational talent with a little bit of hype on you, sometimes veteran players want to show it's not going to be as easy as it was in college. And I think that's a little bit of what we're seeing. So now, right now, you know, Clark is bringing in a lot of new eyeballs to the WNBA. Maybe people aren't used to seeing the women's game be so physical. We're seeing a lot of debate and discussion about it right now. I think it's great for the WNBA. More is more for them, and Caitlin Clark talked about it, and she's fine.
Okay, and in a few words, you surprised she was left off Team USA's Olympic roster this summer?
You know, I am surprised. I'm not shocked, just because I heard mumblings earlier this year in the women's basketball world asking, you know, who could you really leave off this roster for Caitlin Clark? It's a really, really deep talent pool on the U.S. side for the women. I'm a little surprised because there would have been a lot of eyeballs on those games, but not shocked.
Finally, a massive upset in men's T20 Cricket World Cup. The United States beat the perennial powerhouse Pakistan. I can't even, cricket scores are impossible to give. The most important victory ever for American cricket. Help put this victory into some perspective, Michelle.
Yeah, you know, I had to consult with a cricket expert here. I have a colleague, Ben Baby, who covers the NFL, but he watches a lot of cricket, and he said this is like Trinidad and Tobago beating Germany in the World Cup. Others have called it the biggest upset in international play since the miracle on ice.
You know, that's an analogy that is lost on me, but go ahead, yes?
Yeah. Well, the miracle on ice, we all know that, right?
Miracle on ice, I know, yeah.
A bunch of college hockey players from the United States defeating the Soviet Union. This is on that level. I'll say this much. Most of us don't understand the rules of cricket. I am one of them, but we are dominating right now. So on that note, USA, Scott.
Yes. USA, Michelle Steele of ESPN. Thanks so much for being with us.
You bet.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. The editor of the Stanford University's student newspaper is calling on the school leadership to back off felony charges against a reporter who was arrested this week while covering pro-Palestinian protests. KQED's Joseph Jihad reports.
Kashiki Nayudu, the editor-in-chief of the Stanford Daily, says one of the paper's reporters, Dylan Gohill, was covering protesters occupying the university president's office. In a statement, Nayudu said Gohill was arrested even though he identified himself as a journalist and was wearing a press badge. Gohill, like the protesters, was charged with felony burglary and held on $20,000 bail. He's since been released. The university has said that all students arrested will be suspended as well. Nayudu said, quote, "We hope the university will lift his suspension and we urge the DA's office to drop the charges against him." I'm Joseph Jiha, KQED News.
Juneteenth celebrations are kicking off today in the Bay Area with a parade in downtown San Francisco. Today's celebration is the second annual Juneteenth parade for the city. KQED's Pendarvis Harshaw reports.
Today's celebration is the second annual Juneteenth parade for the city. While San Francisco's black population has dropped by as much as 50% in the past 50 years, organizers of the celebration say having a parade down Market Street in honor of black culture is a symbol of freedom. In addition to the San Francisco parade, there will be numerous events around the Bay Area throughout the month of June. That includes a battle of the bands from historically black colleges and universities in downtown San Jose, the Berkeley Juneteenth Festival on Adeline and Alcatraz Street, and the Juneteenth Family Day Parade and Festival at Nickel Park in Richmond. To see the full list, check kqed.org/arts. I'm Pendarvis Harshaw, KQED News.
The parade starts at 11 a.m. I'm Natalia Navarro, KQED News.
Support comes from Paint Care. Leftover paint can be dropped off and recycled at nearly 800 sites in California. PaintCare.org. Time now for a perspective, our daily listener commentary series. Where do our lost things go? And will we meet them again in this life or the next? Here's a perspective from Paul Staley.
If there is an afterlife, I have a request. Of course, I want to see all the people I've loved who have passed on before me, but I'd also like a reunion with all the things I have lost along the way. We'll need a pretty big room. There'll be a big mound of golf balls and a large assortment of unmatched socks, hats, clothing, sunglasses, keys. The list of invitees will be long. These were all things that at one time were possessions of mine, although my grip proved not that tight. Their hold on me, however, was never stronger than when I couldn't find them. It'll be an emotional occasion. I still miss some of them, and I imagine there'll be hard feelings on their part. Why wasn't I more careful, less absent-minded? I'll tell them how much I beat myself up about their disappearance, but in the end, that can't change the outcome. I will ask what happened after we parted ways. Perhaps they wound up belonging to somebody who took better care of them. I hope so. I'd hate to think of all of them heading straight to a landfill. Our relationship was always a two-way street. Yes, I got use out of them, but it was me who released them from the limbo of inventory and gave them a role in the world. But in the end, there will be no avoiding this awkward question. Did I ever replace them? For some, the answer will be yes, and I hope that answer is taken as evidence of their importance and not an indication that they are mere commodities. For the rest, there may be a brief surge of pride that comes from being labeled irreplaceable. And that could soon be followed by this troubling thought. Perhaps I decided that I didn't really need them. Possession, after all, is often the result of appetite and desire and not necessity. And this reckoning of whether you need something or merely like it is something that ought to be done in this life and not in whatever comes next. With a perspective, this is Paul Staley.
Paul Staley lives in San Francisco. Hear more stories like Paul's on our podcast. Just search KQED's Perspectives on your favorite podcast app. Support for Perspectives comes from Comcast, dedicated to serving California communities by offering digital equity initiatives and providing financial donations to help families and seniors get online and participate in the digital economy. More at california.comcast.com.
I'm Peter Sagal, and a huge surprise this week, Boeing launched a spacecraft into orbit. That's it. That's the surprise. Join us for the news quiz that never malfunctions. That's Wait, Wait from NPR.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. It comes your way at 11 o'clock this morning and again at 6 p.m. and then tomorrow morning at 10. We have cloudy skies to start out the day, partly cloudy, maybe some hazy sunshine later on today. It's cool in San Francisco, just a high of 64 expected, but then 70s in the North Bay and the South Bay and upper 80s in the Sacramento Delta.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. President Biden is in Paris on a state visit. Appearing jointly with French President Emmanuel Macron, Biden said Russia poses a risk to all of Europe, not just Ukraine. He also welcomed the news from Israel that the military has rescued four hostages kidnapped by Hamas on October 7th. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is heading back to the Middle East. He's to gain support for a plan for a ceasefire in Gaza. And in horse racing, the Belmont Stakes takes place today. Its usual home on Long Island is undergoing a $500 million renovation, so it's been moved to Saratoga Springs, New York. The Belmont Stakes is the final jewel in the Triple Crown. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from USPS, dedicated to providing businesses with shipping options, working to help businesses avoid shipping challenges with USPS Ground Advantage. Learn more at usps.com/advantage. And Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, working to target and destroy cancer-causing proteins with protein degradation. It's how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Dana-Farber.org/everywhere and the listeners and supporters and members of KQED Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Beth Heisinger. Time now is 18 minutes before 9 o'clock.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Hitman and a maybe client walk into a diner, but it's no joke.
Did you always know you wanted to be a...
Not exactly a childhood dream.
Do you ever think about it?
I don't overthink things. I'm not very sentimental.
Yeah, well, we all have regrets.
Well, in my line of work, I can't afford to think that way.
College professor Gary Johnson moonlights as an undercover police operative to get the goods on people who would like to book real hitmen, which don't really exist, according to the film. Hitman is a dark rom-com from Richard Linklater, who says it's mostly based on a true story. Glenn Powell plays the college prof turned undercover cop, and Adria Arjona plays his potential client. She joins us from Los Angeles. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is quite a film. You play a woman named Madison, and she's in trouble, isn't she?
Something like that. When we first meet Madison, she's coming out of a really troublesome relationship that she feels like there's no way out of it. And she hires a hitman. She meets Gary. To her, it's Ron. And Ron kind of lets her off and tells her that she has other options. And for the first time, someone has listened to Madison. And then their story just kind of kicks off from there.
Yeah. What's it like to work in a Richard Linklater film? This is a director who famously shuns Hollywood and is widely admired.
I don't want to sound cliche, but it really is like a dream come true. I've always sort of aspired to be an actress like the ones in Richard Linklater movies. I always feel like performances are always so fresh and feel improvised. And it's quite the opposite. We rehearsed for 2.5 weeks. We ate breakfast, lunch, and dinner together. We would write and try things. And he really gives actors ownership over their characters and allows them and invites them into the writing room. He's just such an egoless man and really truly believes that filmmaking is an art of collaboration.
There's so many levels of acting and being going on. People pretending to be people who are pretending to be themselves. How do you avoid getting lost in the layers, or is that the point?
I think that's a little bit the point. You know, I love this about these characters, that they're in constant reinvention of themselves. And, you know, Madison, now she's trying to figure out sort of who she is and who she wants to become. And the fact that he is doing it exactly the same, you know, he's playing this character, Ron. So role play is definitely this couple's love language.
Where's the chemistry come from? How do you develop that on screen?
You know, Rick always says either chemistry exists or it doesn't. And I'm starting to kind of believe that a little bit. I know that it's part of my job to create it, but in this specific instant, it kind of just was there. And, you know, the first time we met, we spent 5 hours together talking. I mean, we couldn't shut up, Glenn and I. And I think, you know, if I have to answer that question, I think it would be just trust. And I think since the minute I met Glenn, I just knew I could trust him. I had his back, he had my back, and we kind of worked in a symbiotic form.
When you say you have each other's back, you mean you share the goal of making each other look good?
More than look good. I think
be good.
Feel comfortable, because, you know, at the end of the day, those scenes are always uncomfortable. So having his back and making sure that he can feel comfortable and that I make him feel safe and he does the same thing for me, I think was the most important thing for the both of us.
What kind of scenes are you talking about?
Just their most intimate scenes, if I could say that.
There are
some steamy and yeah, intimate scenes. Do you remember those?
I do indeed.
There's
a lot of
those.
Yeah.
This is a bad idea.
I suppose it is.
For instance, we can never go to my place.
Good, I don't want to.
I can never give you any info about my whereabouts at any time.
I will see you when I see you.
And we can only get so personal.
Okay, what's your next line? Don't fall in love with me. I know what this is. We're just gonna meet here whenever we want, and nothing outside of here matters.
What do you think moves Madison and Gary to become partners? And I won't specify if it's crime or life or whatever.
I think the fact that they're both in this mode of reinvention, they're both trying to be the best version of themselves for the other person. They're not necessarily doing it for themselves. You know, it's constantly rewarding when Ron likes something that she does, and vice versa. You know, they're playing people that they can only dream of becoming. So it makes it into this really fun and exciting game for themselves. And, you know, people do this all the time when they go on dates. You know, the first three dates, they're the best version of themselves. Fourth day, all the truth comes out.
Well, I mean, without giving anything away, the best version of themselves, but they do some dreadful things, don't they?
They do. Yes, they they do, for the sake of commitment.
Oh, all right.
Well, you got to watch the movie to know what I'm talking about. It's hard.
I know. I did, but you know.
Crazy stuff. They do. These two are partners in crime for sure.
Yeah. You were born in San Juan, moved to Mexico City and Miami, then left to go to New York City when you were 18. What are some of the jobs you had on your way to becoming a star?
I was actually born in Caguas, Puerto Rico, half Puerto Rican, half Guatemalan. Yeah, I mean, I was a clown for little kids' birthday parties, and I would paint little kids' faces to kind of make money and go to New York. And then in New York, I was a hostess, a waitress, a bartender. I worked at events, sort of passing hors d'oeuvres to people that I can only dream of working with one day. And now I'm in the same world.
What's ahead for you as an actor? And anything in particular you'd like to do?
Oh, there's a lot of stuff that I want to do. I feel like this is just the beginning for me. I'm at a place right now where the realization of how many movies I can do in my lifetime kind of kicked in. Mm-hmm. So, you know, who I spend the time with, both as an actor, meaning who I spend the time with in character, and who I create with, has become really important to me. I want to spend 3 months with this character, with this group of people, and have a collaborative experience and come out of it learning, and hopefully it works, and hopefully we do what we all seek to do, which is to move an audience. That's what's really my main priority now, and to continue challenging myself and playing in different genres and not just staying in one lane, I think is really important for me, and it's important for me as a Latin American woman to keep switching lanes.
Aldora Arjona stars in the new Richard Linklater film, Hitman. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. This was lovely.
Meghan Trainor and I had some catching up to do.
Because you know I'm all about that bass, no trouble.
You and I just realized it's been 10 years since we interviewed you about your first big hit.
Yes.
How do you feel about the song now?
She's like my firstborn. And she's very important to me because she just made all of my dreams come true.
You speak of that song as a her.
Yes, sometimes. I look at that song and I see the younger me that was there, and she was so afraid and thrown into everything, not knowing what was going on.
I mean, do you feel like a different person now?
Oh, yeah. My dad told me that it takes 5 years to practice and learn your craft. And after 5 years, I was like, Dad, I don't think I got this yet. Like, I don't feel like I've learned it yet. And now I'm 10 years in and I feel way more confident. I know what to expect. It's definitely like, I got a handle on this now. Nothing's forever.
Finding self-confidence is a big theme of Meghan Trainor's new album, Timeless. And the title track is contemplative, bluesy, departure from her signature upbeat pop. It's a beautiful song.
Thank you. Yeah, that one's a very important song to me because I was trying to talk about my fear of losing someone or time, but I also wanted it to be a beautiful love song at the same time. Like, you could play it at a wedding, or you could use it to cry while, like, missing someone.
Anyone in particular you held in your mind as you were putting that song together?
My kids. I think it's from being a mom, a new mom of two young babies. I'm like, I finally realized, like, oh, the meaning of life, you know, and it's them, and I just love them so much. But also I watched my friend lose her dad in a short year to an aggressive cancer. And it just didn't make sense to me. And that's what I talk about in this song of, like, there's too many memories and there's too much love. Poof, it's all done one day. Like, that doesn't sit well with me. So I try to put it in a song.
Let me ask you about, I guess, Riley, who must be about 3 years old, and Barry, born in 2023. What do you think of when you look at them?
Just the disbelief of that they're here. And I'm just like, how are you here? Where have you been? I've missed you. I always tell them that. Or even if they nap, I tell them I miss them after. you know, when you meet a celebrity that you love and they're your hero and then they turn out to be really awesome. Mm-hmm. When Riley or Barry, like, look at me and smile, I'm like, oh my God, my favorite superstar knows I exist. I'm a fan.
Let me ask you about your songs, I Want to Thank Me and Bestie. You call them self-love pop bangers?
Yeah, self-love anthems, yes. Late night when I'm in bed, got voices in my head. They've never been my friends. I
voices in your head or just voices screaming on social media platforms?
No, it's me and them, but self-doubt or like when you start to spiral, I try to capture that in this verse of when I'm up at night and I can't fall asleep and I can't shut my brain off. That's what I tell my husband. And that's when I turn on the true crime, the Dateline. I have to listen to something else and escape my reality, or I will just like start to worry about like what's ahead and go in circles. And I'm really working like with my therapist.
That must be very difficult to live with. That being said, do those voices somehow also motivate you to do new things and try things?
Oh yeah, like I've noticed I'm going into my 30s trying to say yes to everything that scares me or things I think I won't be able to do. I try to say yes to those opportunities. I didn't ever dream of being this far in my career, so I'm not going to stop now, and I'm going to just try to keep going and keep dreaming, you know. Look at myself like, ooh, she cute. Loving myself like Lucy too.
About to get high of an ego boost. All the way to the moon. Cause things like climbing Mount Everest or...
That's like not on my bucket list, but like touring again, you know. I'm going on tour in September, and I haven't done that in 7 years because it scares me. And I'm touring arenas, and that's like been on my bucket list, like a big dream come true for me. I just, every time I toured in the past, I would need vocal surgery. So that's another thing I'm afraid of, but I'm more excited than afraid for this tour.
And you know who I want to thank? I want to thank me for believing in me. Doing what they said I could not do. Make me feel some
type of way. What would you like your music to put into the lives of people?
Oh, happiness, a little smile when the world could be so scary. I hope if they're feeling down about themselves, I hope that my song can try to change their energy and their inner thoughts, hopefully, to make them feel a little better. I think that would be cool. So I hope I'm making people dance and making people happy. I wanna thank me for looking like this. For working my ass off, can't do it like me, I wish. I wanna thank me, kiss myself. I wanna thank me right now and nobody else.
I wanna thank me. I said I'm talking. I have a totally personal question to ask. May I?
Yeah.
Our producer for this interview, Andrew Craig, says that your song Blink is a go-to in his workout mix. You better not blink. You better not blink. Because you don't want to miss this. He wants to thank you personally. And is there a song on this album you would add to his workout mix?
Oh my gosh. First of all, I love you so much. Blink is my husband's favorite song, so thank you so much for saying that. Off this album, I think Hate It Here, like when I'm on a treadmill, that one really gets me going because I hate it, but I can also dance.
Well, all right, we have it from the absolute source, Meghan Trainor, Timeless. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you. Get me out this dress. Want you to take me home. Yes, I hate it here. Goodbye. Cause I'm about to lose my mind. And I know it ain't just me tonight. Get loud if you want.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
One more hour of Weekend Edition. Support for NPR comes from Storyworth. Each week, Storyworth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, they'll publish family memories into a bound book to keep forever. Learn more at storyworth.com. And the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And the listeners of KQED. It's Been a Minute comes your way 1 hour from now. This moment, we're going to go to traffic and look at a crash in Dublin. Here's Lori Sanders. And it is a serious one. We've got three lanes blocked in Dublin, northbound 680 before El Costa Boulevard. It's a two-vehicle crash. It's blocking the two middle lanes, but the CHP is also blocking the two right lanes. We've got traffic stopped back to Stone Ridge. In Daly City, northbound 280 at John Daly.